Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Wisconsin Republican Party Chairman Andrew Hitt previews this weekend's in-person state convention in Green Bay. The state Supreme Court upholds lame duck laws passed after the November 2018 election. Federal judges set a timeline on when in-person absentee ballots can be cast before the November 3 presidential election. And Governor Tony Evers says the Supreme Court ruling that wiped out his safer at home order means he cannot require face masks statewide. And stock picks are back. Rewind, your week in review for July 10.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And Wisconsin Republicans will meet in Green Bay for their annual state convention. So the first part of this show, we're going to interview State Chair Andrew Hitt on the convention. Mr. Chairman, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Steve. Great to be with you, J.R.
J.R. and I have been to, more than a few conventions. So we know they're about excitement, enthusiasm, momentum, building support for your presidential, congressional, and legislative candidates. But there's a shadow over this one, Mr. Chair. Yesterday, a record 750 positives, COVID-19. How do you thread that needle, sir?
So we obviously delayed our convention a couple months, and we took that time to really carefully plan and work with health experts to understand the CDC guidelines. We worked with the venue that has had other events of our size to make sure that we're taking as many precautions as we can to keep people safe. So we've done things like spread things out more, limit the vendors, make sure the registration table is a bigger area so there's less congestion, hand sanitizer everywhere, masks available, extra rows, extra room between rows, between chairs. A number of things that we've done just to make sure that we can keep people as safe as possible. But our folks really wanted to come together. They thought it was very important to come together in this important election year, not only because of the presidential election, but everything that's going on in the state of Wisconsin right now, too.
Okay, Jerry, your turn.
Just walk us through, you talk about the state's precautions. When we spoke earlier this week, you're expecting now 300 people to attend this weekend. Is that still holding? And, you know, obviously that's a fraction of what you usually get. I think you guys told me in 2016 there were 1,200 people there. I think in 2008 you told me like 900, something like at the party, not you personally. But
right.
It's obviously a smaller crowd. But how do you kind of capture that enthusiasm we usually see at a convention with a smaller crowd, a little more space between people, a different vibe? Like what kind of convention – what's a successful convention for you with this new normal?
Sure. You know, what we really want to come out of this convention with is to articulate not only to people who read about the convention or the people who watch it online, but, you know, the people who are there. We really want to communicate and make sure that people understand that there is a choice between the president and between Joe Biden. And voters have a choice. It's a choice between a president who believes in economic opportunity, who believes in freedom, who believes in the rule of law, and Joe Biden, who spent, you know, years, pretty much his whole career in government, and believes that the government is the solution to every problem. We want to make sure that that choice is felt and heard and seen very clearly, because we think if we take that choice directly to Wisconsinites this fall, we're going to prevail.
Mr. Chair, I getting ready for this, I talked to Charles Franklin, the pollster, yesterday, and I asked him about the numbers, support among Republicans and lean Republicans for the president. He told me that in May it was in the 90s, and his latest poll was in the 80s. Now, that's a drop, 7 or 8 percentage points. Are you worried about that, given how closely, given how narrowly President Trump won Wisconsin in 2016, sir?
In the fall is going to be razor close, razor thin. We saw, if we go back and we look at the polls in 2016 and the talk that was going on in 2016, very reminiscent of today. June of 2016, the president down by 9. October down by 7, just days before the election down by 6. Not only was President Trump not going to win Wisconsin and win the White House, he was going to take Ron Johnson down with him. That didn't happen. What we saw in 2016 was this energy and enthusiasm amongst our grassroots volunteers, amongst new volunteers. We're seeing that same energy now. Some of this is just anecdotal, but as we talk to people around the state, as we recruit volunteers, train them, and deploy them, the soft things that we look at are very, very strong right now. So absolutely, any poll that you know has any kind of slippage can be concerning, but what I am focused on right now is our numbers. I'm happy with where our numbers are at, but I'm really happy with the volunteers we're getting, the training we're doing, and the enthusiasm that we're seeing. I think that's going to give us the advantage in the fall, through the summer and the fall. The organization structure that we have gives us an advantage. And if Joe Biden doesn't come to Wisconsin, like Hillary Clinton didn't come to Wisconsin, they're going to have problems. And right now, Joe Biden seems to be focused mainly on his house.
Those poll numbers, this shift in the Marquette poll at least seems to kind of coincide with COVID-19. The president did better with older voters, depending on what definition we use for older. I'm 46, so, but anyway, with those older voters who've tended Republican in past elections, there seems to be a drop-off, right, with COVID-19. Do you think the pandemic, the president's handling of it, has hurt him with a key constituency for Republicans that you need this fall?
Well, I'm 42, JR, so we're going to definitely not count 40s as old. I think you got to be way up there.
Okay, fair enough.
Way up.
Hey, be careful, you guys. Go ahead. I understand. Thank you, Mr. Hip.
That's why I think we need to work so hard to communicate directly to Wisconsinites. Because if you listen to the news, if you listen to the talk out there, you think that the president's response was a complete failure. It couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, $2 billion comes to Wisconsin in CARES Act money. $100 million of that went into long-term care. We look at the Paycheck Protection Program, $18 billion coming to Wisconsin for 142,000 businesses. I mean, that's phenomenal amount of relief that is brought to folks. And so I think when it comes to the fall, when it comes to the election, people are going to sit around their kitchen table and they're going to decide who they're going to vote for. That's what matters. The poll numbers won't matter then. It didn't matter in 2016. It's going to be what is my life look like? And what does my life look like going forward with President Trump or Joe Biden? We know with President Trump, what it looks like is more economic opportunity, more private sector opportunity, more freedom. What it looks like with Joe Biden is more government control of every aspect of your life.
Mr. Chairman, you're meeting in Green Bay. Let me ask you this. Is Green Bay, the Fox Valley, the candidate on November 3 that wins Green Bay and the Fox Valley going to win Wisconsin again in 2016? In 2020.
Yeah, the Fox Valley, where I live here in Appleton, it's extremely important. We always hear about the Wow counties. Now we have the Bow counties. It's very important. And you know, we can go back and we can look at the last couple of elections, and there is some softening for us in the Bow counties. We need to be stronger here, and that's why we're focused on these counties. We need to make sure we have the volunteers that we need, the structure, the organization that we need, so that we can get out there and communicate. You're going to see a lot of focus on the Fox Valley this fall, because it is absolutely critical to winning Wisconsin.
I wanted to look kind of at the state map. This is a unique election, right? We got a presidential race, nothing else statewide, no U.S. Senate race. And the whole thing with legislature is the Democrats is protect the veto, right? You guys have to net 3 seats in each house to get to a 2/3 majority and override the governor's veto, without any Democrats at least. Is it all about how Trump does? If Trump does well in Assembly District X, that Republican candidate will do well. Is there any room to create a unique identity this fall for a candidate in a seat like that, or for a Ron Kind in a seat that the president won 4 years ago, but then snapped back to Democrats 2 years ago?
Yeah. So there's a lot of politics, a lot about politics that is local. You see in the numbers in Wisconsin, I mean, the Tammy Baldwin numbers where Republican legislators win, but those districts went for Tammy Baldwin. We know in the past, although not on the ballot at the same time, that we had Walker Obama voters. Wisconsin voters make decisions on individuals. It's a purple state. We've got a lot of independents in Wisconsin. So there's absolutely room there. And the president is going to lead the way. He won the 7th by 20 points. We're going to see margins like that again there. He won Ron Kind's district by 4.5. We have a great candidate that has been endorsed by the 3rd congressional district in Derek Van Orden. He just put up pretty tremendous fundraising numbers. He's the real deal. He's the real deal there. And, you know, with the president and his coattails in the 3rd, that district is in play for us.
Okay, okay, we've got time for one more question from each of us. So here's my final question, then I'll turn it over to JR's final question. Are you concerned, Mr. Chair, when the president says that he really wants schools to reopen in person or he'll try to pull federal aid, number one? Number two, when he said 99% of COVID-19 infections are harmless, do statements like that worry you, Mr. Chairman?
So, I mean, the president has done a phenomenal job communicating directly with the American people. We've talked lots about that. He is absolutely an asset. He drives the energy, not only if you're in the room with him, but he drives the energy amongst the grassroots. We will work very, very hard to get him elected. And I think that's why it's so important that we communicate directly with people, because those statements are oftentimes out of context or blown out of proportion, or those that are made in jest are taken seriously. It all comes back down to organization, volunteers, training them, deploying them, and making those voter contacts to talk to people about what they care about and get them to the polls and vote for the president in the fall.
Okay, JR, last one.
You talk about that softening a little bit in some of these key areas. And I want to ask you about the president and his, basically his Twitter handle. I mean, his speeches, he's been talking a lot about law and order, a lot about preserving heritage, quote unquote, but some people are interpreting that as him doubling down on Confederate statues, those kinds of things. It seems to be aimed at a base type strategy of maximizing the base turnout. Can the president win re-election or win Wisconsin if he's focused on the base? And is he tone deaf in some ways, these comments, in a quickly shifting discussion about things like Black Lives Matter?
Sure. I don't actually think those are base comments. They're made to be sound like, and you know, the political pundits and strategists and mainstream media want you to think that. The reality is that a great deal of people in this country want to make sure that we have law and order. That goes across every race and every community. People want to be safe in their communities. And once again, we see the Democrats taking things too far when they went to defunding the police. That's a winning issue for us. It's absolutely a winning issue for us, making sure that we respect our and learn from our history and, you know, maintain our history so that we have that, and we have that to learn from, that our kids can learn from it. It's important to a great deal of people. Those are winning issues for the president to talk about.
Wisconsin Party Chairman Andrew Hitt, thanks very much for joining us. We wish you a safe convention in Green Bay. Wisconsin and I will be streaming it, of course. That's what we do at Wisconsin Night. Thanks very much for joining us, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
JR, moving on, let's talk about a Supreme Court ruling today that deals with the challenge to Governor Ray's, Governor Evers, excuse me, Governor Evers' budget vetoes. The Supreme Court was all over the place, but they struck down vetoes that, you and I just saw it. You've read more of it than I did. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty challenged three Governor Evers' vetoes, and the court ruled that the veto that turned $90 million that Republicans wanted set aside for state highway projects into $75 million for local transportation grants and rewrote laws and registration fees for trucks, that was overturned. A veto that turned $3 million for school buses into $10 million for electric vehicle charging stations and $15 million to replace municipal buses, that was overturned. A veto dealing with the taxation of vapor products. Just a P.S. before I give you before I turn it over to you, JR, the court did not rule on challenges to vetoes by former Governor Scott Walker. JR, my question, you and I have been saying for decades that Wisconsin governors have had the strongest veto authority in the nation. Is it too much to say that's no longer true, my friend?
At first glance, yes, and this is why. If you read this decision closely, you don't have a controlling principle of like how the veto power should be reined in. So let's kind of break this apart a little bit, right? One, and I've said this before to you, I have never used the phrase, I've never seen this before so many times as I have in the last few years. In this case, you have basically a writing from the court saying these three vetoes are overturned, but you don't have a majority that agrees on why in any way, shape, or form on all three. So one veto survives, okay, one of the registration fees. On the other three, you have the conservative justices in various coalitions voting to overturn them. But Chief Justice Pat Rogensack, in her writings, was clear. She's breaking, her words, no new ground with her philosophy. She basically said, we're not going to overturn any precedent with this court. We're going to say, this is the standard. Okay. Then you have Justice Daniel Kelly, another conservative, saying, no, I would overturn basically 8 decades of precedent with Wisconsin Supreme Court rulings because he thinks they're wrong. It should be this. Then you have Brian Hagedorn, another conservative, saying, no, I'm not there. I'm here with this is my standard. Well, here's the thing. Unless you have four justices who all agree on the same standard, there is no standard. Okay. So there's a practical impact of, yeah, those rulings or those vetoes are out the window, but there's no clear precedent for future governors or even for Governor Evers in the next budget say, okay, my line is here whenever I do something. Oh, don't forget, this court's going to change by one come August 1st, when Joel Kurowski joins the court, replaces Kelly. So it's not a clear, it's obviously a loss for Evers on those three vetoes.
Yes.
But as far as like the future, I don't know. And oh, by the way, if you read closely the second decision, which basically the court said it was filed too late. This was from the 17-19 budget. It was filed in October of 19. They said, hey, that's past time, essentially, to do anything. If you read the dissent, because the court took original jurisdiction in that case, which basically means they skipped the lower court. Said, yeah, we're going to take this ourselves and figure it out. Then the court said, okay, we said we're going to take it, but we're not going to figure out anything. We're going to say this was filed too late. Right. Rebecca Bradley, a conservative, said, hey, this was not right. We should have taken this up. And oh, by the way, she thought the two vetoes that Governor Walker issued with both basically struck out individual numbers, create new dates, that was unconstitutional.
Right, right.
So it's one justice joined by Kelly, who's going to be gone in less than a month. But it gives people a roadmap of, oh, by the way, if you come challenge something like this in the future, you've got Rebecca Bradley already on your side in that argument.
That's very true. We have so much news to cover, but now we've got to go to what the court did on Thursday when it handed Governor Evers another defeat. Basically, it upheld the lame duck laws enacted. Okay, November 18, Governor Evers defeats Governor Walker, and Attorney General Josh Call defeats the Republican incumbent. December, the legislature comes back, puts limits on the authority of both the governor, new limits on the authority of both the attorney general. Thursday, the Supreme Court upheld that. It upheld the changes that legislators must approve major settlements negotiated by Josh Call's Department of Justice, upheld the law broadening the legislature's power over rules drafted by state agencies whose leaders are cabinet secretaries. It said the legislature, not governor alone, must approve changes involving Capitol security. Just a footnote, yesterday the governor said the Capitol will remain closed for the foreseeable future, but it did on a technical ruling on guidance documents. Just quickly, the Hagedorn writing for the majority, the legislature may have an institutional interest in litigation implicating the public purse or in cases arising from the statutorily granted right to request the Attorney General's participation in litigation. And one of the dissents from Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, Justice Hagedorn's majority is unsupported by the Constitution and creates a dangerously expansive ability for the legislature to unduly burden and substantially interfere with other branches. JR, as we've repeatedly said, we're not lawyers, but a not wholly unexpected ruling on the lame duck bills, right?
Yes, however, it's also a somewhat murky decision, much like today's rulings, and this is why. The challenge, and let's just focus on what I think is the heart of the case, which are the powers of the Department of Justice. It's an executive branch office. It's separate from the legislature, but it derives its powers from the legislature. In that ruling, the challenge is called a facial challenge. It means there's no actual examples of what's happened or the application of the law. It argues the law is unconstitutional, period, right? It's a kind of a theoretical case. The Supreme Court said in its ruling yesterday that those challenges have a very high bar to meet. It means you must prove that in every circumstance that law is unconstitutional. However, Hagedorn in his writing said here are a couple examples where it would be constitutional. For example, if a lawmaker is the subject of a lawsuit, there would be an obvious interest for the legislature to intervene in that case. But in ruling that way, the court set no limits on where those powers are.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen now is you're going to need more lawsuits of applied challenges, actual examples of the law being applied, to flush out where exactly is that mark for Josh Call, the Democratic Attorney General, and how far he can go.
Right,
this is not the end of the story whatsoever. It is just the first legal battle of several I'm expecting in this case.
Okay. And because we got so much news, we got to keep moving on. But we have to again talk about courts. This time we're talking about the federal courts of appeals, which put limits on in-person absentee voting. This was Rewind took the week off, so this ruling came down. Let's summarize it quickly. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals limited in-person absentee voting to between 2 weeks before the presidential election November 3 and Sunday before the election. It banned faxing or emailing about absentee ballots. It approved a 28-day residency requirement to vote for Congress state offices. It allowed college students to use expired IDs. And very interesting comment by Court of Appeals Judge Frank Easterbrook. Legislators are entitled to consider politics when changing the rules about voting. Very quickly, comments on this, JR?
So interesting here, the court upheld Republican authored laws. We went and looked at the early voting piece, for example. The Republicans narrowed it down to a 2-week period after earlier having a stricter window that they was previously overturned. They went to this new one of 2 weeks. We went and looked at Madison and Milwaukee, which are the two communities that most predominantly use early voting. We found that 1 in 5 voters roughly use early in-person voting, voted earlier in that 2 weeks. So it's not a huge impact on early in-person voting. However, you also have to weigh the impact of mail-in voting this year, right? We are moving toward a largely mail-in election. My guess right now is that from talking to people is I don't anticipate a huge impact from this ruling. Now, that's not going to impact everybody, but with the move toward absentee balloting, it might blunt some ways the impact of this decision.
Okay. All right. New subject, this debate over face masks. Let's hear what the governor said in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling on Safer at Home. Throwing that out, he's completely unsure what powers he may have to order face masks statewide. Let's hear from the governor and a response from Assembly Majority Leader Steinicke, please.
I really don't know if I have the authority to do that. Right now, the Republicans could actually come into session and continue the one that we had. But in turn, we're looking at it, but frankly, the Supreme Court has made it very much more complex than what it ever should have been. And frankly, the Republicans' really interest in everything I do around this topic taking me to the Supreme Court where they know that they'll get a win, it makes it unlikely, but it's something that we are considering.
When we originally were negotiating with the governor on how things should look in the state, we believe that things should be taken on a more regional or local approach. And if those are decisions that counties or local or state governments want to take, I think that's up to them. You know, local approach is what we've been looking for all along. So I think that's where those decisions need to be made.
JR, face masks are something we all understand. The Health Services Secretary says Wisconsin is seeing a surge, as I mentioned, 750. That's a record positives yesterday. Dane County, face masks will be mandated in all public places, and even state employees will have to wear them on the job. Milwaukee officials are working on details, but the governor says his authority is unclear. And Mr. Steinicke said face masks, the GOP is very comfortable with it being a county-by-county decision. Any PSs quickly?
So the only question I have is, is there going to be a lawsuit against the Dane County order? Also the Dane County restrictions on bars that went into effect with new order. Are we going to see these things challenged? Local authorities have their own powers under state law to issue these kind of decisions. But will we see a court challenge, much like the one for the state Supreme Court, that overturned the extended state home order under Governor Evers' administration?
Okay, let's do one more topic before your stock picks. Steinicke and Assembly Speaker August and other GOP leaders, State Rep Plummer, they are proposing bridge loans to what on June 27th was 140,000 people who'd filed for unemployment claims and had not had been paid them or been denied and getting into the appeal process. They want $40 million in undesignated COVID relief funds from Washington. The governor still has authority, I believe, over about $280 million. We can go through a complete breakdown next week. The repayments, so you bridge loan to those waiting for jobless benefits. The repayments would go to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And just to note, DWD, between March 15 and July 4, swamped 4 million claims for jobless benefits. To its credit, Secretary Frostman of DWD said, hey, we have gone from 500 people processing U of I jobless benefit claims to 1,700. Is this a real idea, JR? Is it got any traction?
Idea, but zero traction. Reason okay, why okay. is it's Evers administration. This is done to keep putting pressure on the Evers administration about a situation they, quite frankly, talk to people on both sides out, mishandled somewhat from the early going. But if you're Evers administration and you're trying to get out these unemployment insurance benefits to people, why would you create a new program in a different agency to pump money through that rather than focusing on the effort through DWD? I just don't see, from talking to people, again, both sides, I don't see the administration embracing this idea.
Okay, we got 2 minutes for your stock picks. Go.
Northwest Rising, or East-West Rising. So, long-delayed project. Governor Walker banned it in 2017. Governor Evers says we're getting it back on track. A couple things to note with this. Even though the governor is bringing it back, it wasn't really totally dead. Republicans put $20 million in the budget to try and pay for some work on studies, those kinds of things, keep it in the pipeline. This process requires the feds to reapprove it, get it back on its feet, find a way to fund it. The questions I have are, how are we going to pay for it? And is there going to be another lawsuit? Because don't forget the past efforts to expand that highway, 3.5-mile stretch, also ended in lawsuits. So there are still some roadblocks for the things going to be a done deal. The Medicaid fund, Steve, you and I are both are budget geeks. I look forward to my quarterly report on the Medicaid fund. This was noteworthy because 6 months ago, the state, pre-pandemic, was expecting the Medicaid fund to have a small deficit. Now they're expecting actually a surplus at this finding, which is actually great news. Here's the catch, though. It's driven because we're getting an enhanced federal reimbursement rate for people in that program right now, which goes away in September. So in the first year of the biennium, which ended just June 30th, we have a surplus in the fund that year. But we have a two-year budget. And the second year, we have a deficit because caseloads are increasing. They're going to peak. The growth rate will peak in the second quarter of this fiscal year, but keep growing even after that. It puts us in a bad place for the next budget if the enrollment cases keep growing. And as somebody told me this week, as the economy goes, the Medicaid program goes. The higher unemployment goes, higher the enrollment goes. So we could be in a very difficult spot with Medicaid come 21-23.
You got 20 seconds on falling.
Real quick, smoking rates are down. 10 years after the indoor smoking ban went into effect, they've dropped in their 4 points. So good news for health advocates.
Hey, thank you for less than 20 seconds. Wisconsin Eye, as I said, will be covering the Republican State Convention. Wisconsin Eye is interviewing candidates for the August 11th primary. We've got more than 50 interviews up. We'll be doing more next week. And I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for July 10.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.